Coming up on this episode of This Week in Radio Tech, we've got a great show. It's a lot of fun. We're talking about, hey, kind of a throwback to some analog problem solvers, and we're looking at the future of audio ahead of us. I think it's really exciting. It's going to be good. Mike Catfish Dosh is our host. Chris Tobin's here on Twirt. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the Ruby console from Lavo, see Lavo and your future at lavo.com/twirt. And by Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the this microphone right here to the light bulb at the top of the tower and all the stuff in between. And today, today's show is pre-recorded for broadcast at the usual time, Thursday, November the 8th. And most of us are busy at that time, so we pre-recorded this a couple days early. And no matter, we've got a great show for you. I'm Kirk Harnack. Part owner of some radio stations. I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance, who sponsor the studio back here. And we do this podcast, so we're glad to have you along. My co-host is here from somewhere around New York City. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, welcome in.
Why, thank you. I'm actually in New York City. Yes, I'm on the island of Manhattan.
It looks kind of dark there. Is it daylight savings time make it dark outside right now?
Oh, yes. The sun has set. That's it.
That's what it does, huh?
It's a blue hour right now. It's a perfect time for some photos.
Oh, okay. All right. Not the golden hour, but because the blue hour. Yeah, you got that little bit of shimmering light in the sky, and then all the street lights are on in New York City lighting the place up. When does New York City get its Christmas makeover?
That starts December 6th when the tree goes up and is lit in Rockefeller Center. But then again, when Santa arrives at Macy's on Thanksgiving Day, starts the season, and then all the lights start to occur. But shortly thereafter,
That's a magical time. Magical time to be in New York City. It sure
is. Best time.
No, I agree. Yeah. Fresh credit card and off you go.
That too.
All right. Well, you quit bouncing my monitor here. All right. Let's bring in our guest today is a fellow that I've known for a long time. Man, I met this guy in the year 2000 at an NAB show. His name is Michael Catfish Dosh. Welcome in, Mike Dosh. How are you?
Howdy, Kirk. It's good to see you again. And was it 2000? Really?
It was the NAB at 2000. It was April 2000.
Well, you look just the same. Just maybe 20 years older.
Yeah, is that the way the show's going to go? Okay. Oh, man. No, I'm definitely older. And let's see, I'm older. I'm two wives farther along, and I've got a great kid. So how about that?
Yes, you do have a great kid.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mike Dosh is our guest today. And Mike, we'd like to just get a little quick taste of what we're going to talk about today. Of course, you've been through a number of high profile companies that make audio gear for broadcasters, Pacific Recorders, Telos and Axia and Lavo. And you're doing something else kind of interesting now. What would that be?
I am, actually. And you know, the thing is, I don't think I can hold a job. I think that's why I've been through all those high profile positions. So I have started something new, called Angry Audio. In fact, we're one of your sponsors. And, what we're doing is we're making small problem solving devices. And, in fact, I'm going to put this in a way that I think you'll really appreciate. Nothing over $1,000.
Okay.
Something a little bit different. Because when I used to work at Pacific Recorders, we sold very expensive radio consoles and cart machines and everything else. And Telos and Axia, we sold pretty expensive things. And Lavo is very expensive things. So it's nice to be doing something that that people can afford. How's that?
That's an interesting way to look at it. Last week, we'll get into an ad here in just a minute. And I appreciate you being a sponsor, by the way, and getting people to know about the cool devices that you're making, that you're designing for broadcasters and podcasters. So we'll get into that. Another thing that we're going to talk about during the course of the show, and I think this will be interesting to a lot of us, engineers, people who are in broadcasting and doing technical things, is kind of talk about where we've been and what's next. Because one of the things that a guy that's in Catfish's position is that he gets to see, you know, what sells, what doesn't sell, what are the trends, and he gets to, you know, think a bit about what would be next. In fact, Catfish, I noticed on the bookshelf behind you, there's a book I thought I saw was Selling What's Next. And that sounds like maybe along the lines of you know, you design What's Next. You had a hand in designing the first broadcast audio over IP system. You and Steve Church and some other clever folks over at the Telos Alliance had to do with that. So that's the kind of stuff that's coming up. We're going to talk about that. Chris Tobin is here. I'm here. And Mike Dosh, we often call him Catfish, is here, and that's what we're going to talk about. So our show is brought to you in part by Mike's new company, Angry Audio. And we did a 60-second ad for Angry Audio last week. We talked about a it's got buttons on it. What does that do, Mike?
I think the one we were advertising was the talk show gadget.
Yes, and, that's it.
That particular product allows you to take one of these ubiquitous small live mixers, and they're everywhere. You know, the small Yamaha and Mackie mixer that you can find pretty much everywhere, and use it for broadcast. A lot of people ask about that, especially podcasters. In fact, podcasters are a very interesting group because they don't come at it from the radio broadcasting perspective. They come at it maybe more from a live sound perspective. So they you generally see a lot of podcasters and netcasters using inexpensive live mixers in radio. So when you tell them, when they ask questions like, well, how do you light up that on-air sign out in the hallway in radio? You know, because they're familiar with it, but they have no clue. Well, how do you turn that thing on and off? And or the another thing that's been very popular with the podcasters, they love these Mica mic arms. Beautiful ones that have the on-air tally right on the front of them. And, but they'll ask the question. They'll say, well, when I turn my microphone on my live mixer, it doesn't make that red light turn on. So, there are a few tricks that we are pretty familiar with in radio that the podcasters would like to also be exposed to. And, so that's one of the things that we're doing at Angry Audio is we're packaging up some ideas that are very useful and very common in radio broadcasting. And we're making them available to podcasters and netcasters.
If I could say this a little bit different.
That's a talk show gadget.
Yeah, if I could say this a bit different way. So people, you said podcasters often come at this from a different angle. They find out what a radio console costs, and they go, but I can buy a Behringer console for under $200 or a Mackie mixer for $500, $600, $700. I still need to light the light, and it doesn't have a button to do that. And I don't have a good way to listen to, some other, external mix. If you do want to use this for radio. So your talk show gadget adds the functionality, to a cheap console that people might want to have, might be expecting to have.
I think that's exactly right, Kirk. One of the things that I'm kind of interested in is how do podcasters come at this in the first place? And what I've learned as I've researched this is they almost never look at it from a radio perspective. Most of them will go to a friend, maybe their church sound guy, or they'll talk to somebody who's in a band and they'll say, so what do I want to do? If I want to be a broadcaster, I need a microphone and some headphones and a mixer, right? Well, that musician or that church sound guy is not going to point them to radio. He's going to point them to, as you say, the little low cost mixer. And the few times when we do try to talk to podcasters and netcasters about, radio consoles, and let's face it, they start at 2000 at the very bottom end, and then they go up 10 times that much. It's sticker shock. So being able to adapt something that's inexpensive to do more of what they need to do is a nice approach for these guys.
Yeah. So your website where people can see not only the talk show gadget but other gadgets that we'll talk about in future shows, the website is angryaudio.com. And it's a beautiful website that lays out the few products that you're making now. And I guess you'll have announcements for new ones when you have them available there.
Sure.
Or here. Or here on the show.
Or here on the show. In fact, I even brought some of them in here. If you do want to talk about them, I can show them to you on camera. It's almost live.
Yeah. So sure.
You want to see them?
Okay. let's say the ad's over. Now let's get back in the show. And so this is kind of what's next. So, it's always, use both an entrepreneur's and a user's dream to be able to do the same thing for less money. And, there are plenty of places where real traditional or new radio broadcast style consoles are certainly called for. We produce this show typically without a console. At the GFQ network, there is a real radio console there. But sometimes we go on the road, and there's been times when we've used a little cheap Behringer mixer. I think it was $149, and it has a USB connection over to my laptop. So, people look for inexpensive ways to get things done. So else you got?
Well, I have something here. I'm going to go off camera for just a second.
Sure.
This is a brand new product. This is called the Guest Gizmo. And what the Guest Gizmo is it's several things that you absolutely have to have. Let me make sure it's kind of in focus here. If you've got a guest in a radio studio, one of the things that you have to have, and you don't really think about this too much. Oh, in radio, we're really familiar with this, but you need to have a cough button. Got to clear my throat. And really, that's a horrible thing to do on the air with a live microphone. So being able to mute while you make your disgusting noises is a pretty useful thing. In fact, I'm going to call it essential. And so as I was thinking about putting the cough button out there for the broadcaster, it also occurred to me that you really need a headphone app wherever you have a guest position. Mm. And maybe that's not such an obvious thing until you think about it. You never have a guest position without headphones. So there's a headphone amp, there's a headphone jack, there's a unique volume control so every guest can set his own level to taste. And then the third thing that we have, and this is kind of around the back here, is we have a logic connector. And the logic connector allows us to drive the red light on one of those mic arms that we were talking about earlier. So, in fact, what happens is when you plug the connector into the logic port here, the Guest Gizmo kind of adapts itself. It says, I understand. You don't want to be just a cough button anymore. You now want to be an on-off cough button. And so it just automatically knows what to do when you plug something into the logic port. So this is and maybe the most interesting thing about this particular product is maybe the shape is a little interesting to you. I'm going to get the camera around here this way a little bit. You'll notice that it's got this bezel around the outside. Well, the reason for this is so that you can drop this thing into a grommet hole. And believe me, I'm not handy. So when I was thinking about these devices going in a tabletop, the last thing I wanted to have to do was deal with a router because I know I'd cut some fingers off. But even I, with a hole saw that I can get at Home Depot for $10, can make a grommet hole. So that's what these fit into. All of our gizmos fit into grommet holes. They just drop right in. And then all you have on the surface is this nice exposed bezel.
So you're putting wait.
You keep saying grommet hole. Wait. And camera's on the wrong side here. There we go.
Okay. You keep saying grommet hole. Is this the hole that is in the top of a lot of MDF wood desks where your monitor cable comes up through and the power cord and your lamp cord? Okay.
So that's exactly right. Hole. You're probably familiar with this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. Chris, check that out, man. That's pretty cool.
That's what you usually see in a grommet.
So wait a minute. You really are fitting a square peg into a round hole.
Literally.
Yes.
Literally a square peg in a round hole. Exactly.
And that's
right.
Why the bezel's kind of big. It covers up the round hole. Okay.
That's exactly right. And you probably remember that I designed a bunch of these types of devices for Axia. And there were two things that people didn't like about the Axia panels. And by the way, they're loved, but there were two things that I used to get complaints about. And one of them was the price, of course. No one likes to pay for these things. But the other one was, and I got to hire a carpenter to come in and cut the holes because they're rectangular. Mm-hmm. So that was always in the back of my mind. So I kind of had this notion that if we used round holes, and by the way, I did this experiment on myself. I actually installed the prototype in a table and I didn't cut anything except the table. So AJ was really proud of me. She had 911 standing by.
All right. So what we have here is I've never seen anything like that. You have a tabletop. You want a guest position. You want to drop this panel in this kind. And you, as you said, it's kind of smart. It's not just a cuff switch, but it can recognize if you plug something into it, like a Mica arm logic. It'll recognize that it'll be on and off and cough. So what's the sequence of buttons that you push to make that happen?
Well, there's only one button. So if you push it once, it's on. If you push it again, it's off.
Yeah.
If it's on and you push and hold it for a little while, it says, you're muting.
Oh, you're coughing.
And, you're coughing. And so when you let go, it stays on at that point. Okay. And, it's actually a pretty well-known, button sequence. You know, you see this in some broadcast products already. So it's, we didn't really invent that, but we did want to try to figure out how to put it all together with one button. So that's an example of a gizmo.
Chris, I like this because it sounds like, my carpentry skills, at least for cutting square holes, are no better than catfish's. But if you can operate a drill with a hole saw, and I've got those attachments, if you can drill a hole of the right size, then you can look like this looks very finished. And the engineer becomes a carpentry hero.
He really is a hero. And by the way, you'll notice I'll try to get the angle right this time toward the camera, that the bezel is considerably larger than the box. And that's because when I drilled the hole, I wobbled. And so I ended up with kind of an eccentric hole, but the bezel covered up that whole mess, and it looks beautiful when it's sitting in the table. So
covered the whole mess.
It covered the whole mess. Yeah, no pun intended. So that's a gizmo. And then the other products that we have are gadgets. And in fact, you asked about I'll hold one up. I'll try to get the camera right this time. This is the one you were asking about a little while ago. This is the talk show gadget.
Mm-hmm.
And instant on off buttons. So, normally on those small mixers, you use a fader to bring the level up and down. And if you wanted it to be off, you would actually pull the fader all the way to the zero position. Well, that's kind of inconvenient, especially if you wanted to set up a mix and get it right and then just be able to turn people on and off. And so these are instant access to turning buttons on and off. Wait a minute. There they are, buttons. And then we have a control room monitor volume control, which you could use to feed some power monitors. You have the ability to that would be right there. You have the ability to use an external input, which is very useful in radio. We like to listen to what's coming out over the air. So not just the output of our console, but we generally want to set up a tuner someplace, or maybe a satellite decoder, or maybe an internet decoder, and listen to our actual broadcast. So this gives us the ability to do that. And around back, we have a logic connector, and that allows us to light up our on-air sign, do some other things. And all of the I/O connectors in this case are phono plugs, and they're wired balanced tip ring sleeve. And the reason for that is because this is a common connector that you're going to find on those low cost mixers. So it allows you to use a prefabricated cable, just off the shelf, Guitar Center.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's that product. We have a fail-safe gadget, which is kind of fun. This one is really a very fancy A-B switch.
Oh, so, okay.
Can you see that okay? Is that all right?
Yeah, there's a glare from the light. There you go. It'd be good.
Yeah, how about that? So we've got an A-B switch, and then the A input is always monitored. And so if your audio goes silent for a period of time, then it switches over to B. And you've got some controls that you can set. You can define silence. You could say, well, it's going to be 18 dB down for 8 seconds. And if that happens, I'm considering that a silence event, and I want you to switch over to a backup audio source. So that's what this device does. And it gives you some pretty cool functions, like it can automatically recover. So when the main channel comes back and everything's healthy, it could switch back or you could leave it. So you've got some different options. Like I said, they're small problem solving devices.
A product like that already exists in the broadcast world, Catfish. And I know you know that. So what kind of dollars are we talking about for
for that silence and program fail safe?
It's a few hundred dollars. Okay. Yeah, they're all pretty much in that price range. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is a distribution amplifier. This is a fun product. Every broadcaster knows exactly what distribution amplifiers are and why you need them. But it's fun to talk about this with a podcaster or a netcaster, because he thinks that if he just takes the output of his console and he ships it off and daisy chains it to a bunch of destinations, that everything's going to be okay. And he's a little surprised when he ends up with a ground loop or he accidentally, the worst case is he accidentally doesn't plug a connector in all the way, so he shorts out his main program.
Oh, and, yes, yeah.
Well, you know, but that's the funny thing, Kirk, is we know this stuff because we build broadcasting equipment, but you don't know this if you do live sound or church audio. You know, these are different applications for these guys. So being able to introduce them to problems, real problems that they're going to have and solutions for them is kind of fun.
Now, I'm sure in New York City, Chris Tobin never did that, but I sure did. You know, when I was cutting my teeth on broadcast engineering in Central Kentucky, and you know, going to a radio station and hooking up some console output to seven things, and then all of a sudden we noticed that there was hum and buzz and it didn't work, and one of the seven things went bad, and so then it's shorted and there's no audio. Yeah, I learned that the hard way and started looking at there's this thing called a distribution amp. I probably worked at 20 radio stations before I actually got to use, install, repair, fix, whatever, configure a distribution amp. And then, of course, you know, for the next 20 years, we use distribution amps. And if you're getting into this, you know, to podcasting or live sound, maybe some house of worship sound, something like that, and you need your audio to go to several different places at the same time, well, this is what you use. So you're making these, in broadcast, we're used to these. Chris, did you ever do
that? Right.
Did you ever hook one thing to seven inputs?
Well, sure. Did you ever use a 66 block, the 1x6? Everybody's done that.
Sure. Yeah. You know, that was the neat way to do it.
The source, so then you have five pins to the right and just keep tallying off. So high, low impedance, as long as you do high, low. Of course, you have no isolation. So if you short one of them out, everything goes dead. But at least you have some distribution, very passive. But it's also passe nowadays, which you're probably better off with an active distribution amp. Gives you a little more control, especially if you're doing a netcast or podcast, because most of your sources are at different levels, consumer levels and whatnot. Distribution amp with a little control in the front helps you compensate for that. If you do it passively, you're getting nowhere fast.
You said an important word there, Chris. You said isolation. And a lot of folks don't realize that's what you need. If you've got an output from, let's say you have a Behringer console and you need to send it to three or four or several different places. Hey, this needs to get a feed of that. And this does, and this does, and this does. You want each of those to end up being isolated, so they're not just all ganged together, right?
If you gang them together and you unplug those RCA jacks or the tip ring sleeve jacks, they lay on the table and they all of a sudden fall against each other. In a passive arrangement, you've got silence. Then an active arrangement, you continue to have active audio. Just that one source is shorting itself out. Small details that you may not realize have a huge impact on the workflow. Remember, the key is the workflow. The gadgets and gizmos are key to making the workflow function.
This is kind of fun because
I love the way you talk, Chris. The gadget.
It's true.
The gadgets and gizmos are what? They're key.
Key.
Here, I'll tell you what. Let me show you one more, and then I promise I'll stop with the show and tell. This one's my favorite, actually. I mounted this one in a rack, so you could see what they look like when the gadgets are mounted in a rack. So we got a blank panel, and then we've got a balancing gadget. Now there's three different balancing gadgets. One of them is it's a stereo balancing gadget. Then there's a dual stereo balancing gadget, and those are both one way. So that would be taking maybe a CD player that's unbalanced audio and balancing it. That's why we call it the balancing gadget, and turning it into pro audio. And then this one is the bidirectional balancing gadget, which might be more useful for a device that also records. For example, maybe you have a computer sound card that's unbalanced, and you've got audio outputs from a computer sound card, which are usually horrible, and then audio inputs back into it. And you need to be able to receive and send audio to the computer. And you want to professionalize it. You need to bring it up to normal level, or at least normal level for broadcasting, which is plus 4 dBU balanced. And you want to get rid of the noise and hum that you normally get when you try to connect unbalanced equipment with your pro gear. So here, I'll show you the back. And I know before you even ask me, you're going to say, aren't there like 100 different devices out there that do this?
No. Yeah. There are.
Yeah, but they don't rock.
They don't rock. They don't rock like this one does. And I'll tell you where this one came from. This idea, and I have to give credit to my old boss at Pacific Recorders, Jack Williams. He was the owner of Pacific Recorders. And when I got there, I was a little baby console designer. And I was designing consoles, but of course I was using the Pacific Recorders template, which he designed. And it occurred to me that that all of his products had unbalanced patch sends and balanced patch returns. And I said, I don't think this is right. I think this is wrong. I think if we're going to have balanced patch returns, we need balanced patch sends. And he made the point. He said, not really. If we keep the signals pretty short, and normally they're pretty short when it's an insert jack, that's going to a piece of effects equipment that's pretty close nearby, an unbalanced send is fine. And what we'll do is we will actually bring in an unbalanced audio input into a balanced input, and it will suppress the ground loop, if there is one. So this was a way to use unbalanced equipment in a balanced environment. Essentially, plugging unbalanced equipment into balanced inputs would suppress a ground loop. And that was kind of news for me. So I went off and started doing math and analyzing it. And I came back and said, yeah, but only 20 dB. It's about all you get. You get about 20 dB of common mode rejection when you're trying to balance an unbalanced source. And the reason for that is because of impedance mismatch. It's not truly a balanced source, so the balanced destination gets mismatched and messes up the common mode rejection, and that's what we need in order to suppress, ground noise, essentially. So I've been thinking about this problem for more than 20 years, okay? That was the first time I was exposed to it, but I've always dreamed of, wouldn't it be cool if you could really balance an unbalanced source? And so there's a circuit in the balancing gadget that does exactly that. It gives you about 75 dB of common mode rejection on an unbalanced audio source. And it doesn't lose its ability to suppress that ground noise just because the source impedances are not balanced. It actually can tolerate that. So this is a circuit that's been kind of, bouncing around at least for a while in my head. And I always thought, gee, it'd be great to make a product like that. Why? Probably because we can. You don't need a transformer. It's all active. It's sonically very pure. The audio is very precise and very accurate. And if you did have a ground loop between two pieces of gear, and trust me, if you're using audio equipment, you're probably going to have a ground loop unless you manage to be very careful and keep everything really tight and plug everything into the same exact power source. Generally speaking, that doesn't happen. So this allows you to actually run a long unbalanced audio cable, which is anathema. I know you're both thinking, no way, I'd never run a 100-foot audio cable that was unbalanced. And I really don't recommend it, but it works. And so that's kind of fun. So there you go.
Normally,
that's
normally if we had to do that, if we had to run a long unbalanced cable, we would use a transformer. I haven't put a transformer in years, but so you have this circuit that gives you the specs that a transformer would, but it's transformer
better, actually much better than transformer. Its common mode rejection approaches that of a transformer, but its other characteristics are much better. The transformer, because we're talking about audio here, and audio is pretty delicate signaling. So in order to have a great quality transformer, you're talking about a very expensive device. And even a really high-end audio transformer, like a Jensen audio transformer, yes, it performs wonderfully, but it's still susceptible to hum fields. It's a transformer. So yeah. It's not In some senses, transformers are really great solutions to certain problems, but they're not cheap and they're not perfect. So always I imagine doing this with an active circuit and getting the same kind of performance. And I think we're approaching that now with the gadgets.
So for the folks tuning in and listening who may be podcasters or building studios for the first time, one of the problems that we come across as a broadcaster, I still come across from time to time is when we have a professional line level audio output that's balanced and I've got to go feed a computer sound card with that. Catfish, you alluded to this earlier. And this is the worst situation because that sound card is probably looking for, these sound cards often are so smart that they suffer in performance. Their same input can be a microphone or a line level. And the sound card claims to be smart enough to figure that out, right? So if you feed it very much more than about minus 10 dBV in signal, you're out of dynamic range at the top, and you're going to start clipping. And a couple of my radio stations where we haven't, for one legacy reason or another, like an old computer, we're still feeding a computer from the output of, say, an audio processor. And the audio processor has a strong +4, +8 output. And even if I dial it all the way back, it's still just about too much for the sound card. And I need a balancing gadget in that situation. If you don't have one, you're going to have a bad time.
I think, Kirk, you need an unbalancing gadget in that situation.
Well, yeah.
And I'll fix you up. Let's talk after the show. I'll get you fixed up for your radio station.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Chris, any comment before we go to break on what we've seen so far?
I think it's great. I think if you're really serious about your Netcast podcast, for the $250, the balance, unbalance, and the computer interface, I know from working with two people that do networks, podcasting networks, I've been called. I don't know why I'm getting this buzz and hum. Something's up. What did I do wrong? And I get to the house and I'm like, well, let's just say masking tape and that splice is not the way to go. But they were willing to invest in some other products from other retailers that said, yeah, if you use this device, it'll work just fine. That didn't happen. So for a small investment, I think what Catfish has makes total sense. Well worth it. And you know it's going to last because it's designed that way. And you just can't go wrong. I mean, it makes total sense because you're going to have all types of unbalanced sources in a podcast, netcast environment that's not a broadcast facility. Well, I take that back. I've been in some broadcast facilities that have been using unbalanced stuff. So it could be that too.
Good deal. All right. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, we're in the middle of it with Chris Tobin in New York City, where the sun is already well down because we're out of daylight savings. Also, Michael Catfish Dosh is with us, a former colleague of mine, and he is talking about some cool things from Angry Audio. We're going to get into some speculating as to what's going on in the future of audio and systems and things like that. So hang on for that. I'm broadcasting live, if you're watching this on Thursday, our usual time, we pre-taped it in the Telos Alliance studio. So thanks a lot to the Telos Alliance for helping to make my studio possible. Really appreciate it. All right. We're going to continue with the show here in just a minute. We're going to hear from our friends at Lavo. We'll be right back.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I.O. options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
And thanks to Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. So, you know, between the ad and the things that I know that, Mike Catfish Dosh, our guest, has done and what he's doing now, we're covering a huge gamut of technology from things that help you with good old analog and doing that right and doing it well to, you know, the Lavo ad we just saw. They're talking about consoles that do audio over IP, AES-67, and they're all digital, doing mixing in amazing DSP and things like that. Catfish, we got to pontificate a little bit here on audio, where we've been. And it's funny, you know, you're kind of stepping back and doing what we used to do, but doing it right and well and at an affordable price for the people who are buying the cheaper technology now. My goodness, you can buy a Behringer console for, some of them are $29. And the audio quality is pretty darn good. Decent mic preamps and you can do a podcast, but they don't always solve the whole problem, which is kind of why you're doing this thing.
That is true. And that's a great ad, by the way, the Lavo ad. I like that very much. For the viewers who don't know, I am, in addition to my weekend job, which is Angry Audio, my day job is I'm the radio product manager for Lavo. And so I've been doing this for about 4 years. Actually, I got a promotion recently, but I've been with Lavo for about 4 years. And this is a really interesting company that's doing a lot of cutting edge work in audio for broadcast and also video for broadcast, and primarily over IP. So it's kind of the opposite of Angry Audio. You know, this is the complex IP based, you know, all digital DSP solutions to broadcasting problems. So this is the over $1,000 product. Yeah, you know, the Angry Audio is the under $1,000 product.
I gotta believe that as we move forward, though, as we inevitably do, I gotta believe that we're gonna see more audio over IP products that just work, that maybe are more like a Dante dongle, right? Where it's a single audio analog or AES 3 IO, and it just plugs into a network jack, and it's maybe even powered with power over Ethernet. And the different manufacturers, whether it's Lavo or Wheatstone or Telos Livewire, their Axia division, they make boxes that have a number of IOs on them, GPIO and several audio ins and outs and things like that. You can certainly get these in that speak Dante, for example, and AES-67. But I gotta believe that we're gonna end up, as things become commoditized, as they almost always do over time, we're gonna find home audio, home podcast studio stuff that kind of just plugs together and prices become commodity priced. Now, I'm not talking next year. I'm talking at least five, six years in the future when we start to see these things more commoditized. That's my opinion. What do you think?
I share your view. I happen to really like the Dante dongles. And, you know, for those who don't know what these are, they're very simple. They have an Ethernet. They have an RJ45 connector on one side and either an analog XLR or an AES3 XLR. On the other side, I guess they've got a few different dongles for a few different things. And I love these products. In fact, I have to say that, I guess you know that I was the founder and president of Axia, up until about 5 years ago when Frank Foley bought me out. And, thank you, Frank, by the way. Paid all the bills, and I'm very happy with you. But when we were starting Axia, this was one of the questions that we asked, is how granular can we get? And it was always a cost thing. So if you had a couple hundred bucks worth of Ethernet hardware in a node, that's what we called them at Axia, then somehow you wanted to amortize that over as many audio I/O devices as were practical. So a $200 cost on a dongle probably wouldn't have worked so well. That would have been a $500-$600 thing. Mm-hmm. But tech has moved on, and Audinate's done a good job, and they've figured out how to make a $100-ish single channel or stereo dongle. And I got to tell you, I think that's really it's really cool. And we're finally going to see a point where you don't necessarily have to have these translator boxes in between your network and your audio devices. Now, believe me, I think Axia does a terrific job, and the X nodes are terrific products. But you still have about four devices per X node, and maybe you just have a device that you want to stick on the network. Well, these dongles allow you to move in that direction. And of course, Dante, or Audinate rather, they also have Dante OEM cards and modules that plug into other people's products. So we're seeing so much of this. You know, I mean, I'm not going to say there's Dante on everything, but there's Dante on just about everything. And it does mean that the network audio component has become almost a commodity, maybe not quite a commodity, but it's getting very close to being a commodity. So I do imagine what you imagine. I imagine that at some point in the near future, everything's going to be IP, and it's just going to kind of, you know, these days of the transitional products, they're going to kind of fade away. Everything will be mixed. Network sources will be mixed in some kind of a network appliance. They'll be controlled via some kind of computer device that's also on the network. And then all of the audio I/O just at the very edge is going to be translated as soon as it can be. Mics, headphones, these things of this nature, it's going to be translated very quickly.
So someday, and I want to hear Chris's take on this. Chris was an early adopter of audio over IP technology, sometimes in environments where that was tough to do because, you know, the other guys were saying, nah, we don't need all that stuff. Analog and AES is good enough for us. But actually, let me back up to a different topic there. Catfish, you mentioned transitional products. And when AES3 came out, and this I guess has been what, 25 years ago, maybe almost 30. I started seeing this, I guess in the mid 90s and late 90s, I started seeing AES, and I never worked at radio stations that adopted AES3 technology because, it was to us, well, first of all, we couldn't afford all the fancy consoles that had it. But to us, it was just, well, wait a minute. All this does is cut the amount of wiring in half. It doesn't really have much of any other benefit. It's okay. It's all digital. That's good, I guess. But really good analog is nearly as good as AES digital, and it cut the wiring in half. And it just didn't seem like a solution that had enough benefit for small market broadcasters like me to jump in and buy a bunch of stuff and wire it all. Yeah, I might have had one or two things here. No, I didn't. No, a small station, I really didn't even have one or two things. So I couldn't jump in whole hog, and it didn't have any real benefits. When audio over IP came out in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, then this started to make sense for a broadcaster like my stations. We could spend the same or maybe a little bit more on an audio console and then have our whole infrastructure be audio over IP with a lot of benefits there. And it didn't cost much to make things, like computers into end devices on this audio network, you know, for the cost of literally a $30 network card and an IP driver to run in Windows, then bam, we're all of a sudden that computer doesn't need a sound card anymore, analog or AES3. So that was a big jump. Now, the next jump that I'd like to see is when it just becomes so commonplace. Someday, will we have a day when I buy a piece of audio gear and it doesn't have analog I/O and it doesn't have AES3 I/O? It only has a network connection on it, and that's all.
Why not?
Of course, we. Yeah. That's,
why not?
And it,
the, we've actually talked about this. We talked about it when I was still with Telos. At one point, we had a pretty serious discussion about should we have some LiveWire only devices, and at a different price point. So maybe you would save some money because you didn't have this audio I/O on the device, except for LiveWire, and so maybe the device would be cheaper for you. And I remember having that conversation, and at the time, at least, and maybe we've moved past this now, but at the time, there was still a pretty good mix of customers that were using their products in LiveWire and non-LiveWire applications. And at the time, we felt like there wouldn't be much of a market for a LiveWire-only device. We thought a lot of people would say, you know what, I'm going to spend the extra $200 to get my Omnia One with AES I/O and analog I/O and LiveWire just so I might be able to use it somewhere else in the future in case I'm not always putting it on the LiveWire network. And that was the thinking at the time. But, you know, that was 8 years ago. So have we gotten to the point now where everyone just says, hey, look, it's all IP. We might be at the point where this starts to make sense.
I kind of all good points. I kind of rambled for a while. Chris Tobin, you're the kind of guy that would probably be all over this. No, let's just jump in the future and be there. What are your thoughts?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. My thoughts are you have an RJ jack on your laptop. I'm connected right now with a USB microphone adapter to an RJ45 out to a broadband connection. Here we are. So I'm already got some ubiquity, you know, operations going on. As far as the Dante, someone had asked me about a year ago if I was building a studio or doing replacements at a facility that I'm at now, how would I approach it? And I said, well, I'd probably use a broadcast infrastructure for the broadcast studio, but our performance space where we do live performance recordings, capturing and everything, I said I'd probably do a Dante house because we already have the Sony console, Yamaha gear. And I said, just plug in the cards and have a bridge between the two. And they're like, well, why? I said, well, how cool is it that I can take a dongle, the Dante dongle with a mic connector on it, toss out a cable box, you know, RJ45 box into the studio, plug away and go. I said, it's convenient. I could be anywhere in the building and we can go live with an artist somewhere in one of the studios. But the broadcast side, we could have a rock solid setup that we are familiar with. You know, there's a couple ways you can do it. And I think down the road, probably within 5 years, if not sooner, it will be just a single device that does everything we need, whether it's an RJ45, a lightning connector, a C, USB-C, whatever it turns out to be. I think, and as Catfish pointed out, it's like, you know, do you do a device strictly that does one thing, or do you have multiple things in it, like audio, analog audio, AES, and LiveWire? Well, you're asking the question of what is my workflow? What are we doing? What's the application? And I said, that's what's going to drive where we go with this. You know, you have Apple products that are suddenly slowly disappearing, the connectors on the side. It's becoming just a single little slab of aluminum, and all of a sudden it's like, how do I get it out of it? Oh, that's Bluetooth. Oh, you know, yeah. It's not impossible. It's just a question of who's willing to put up the dollars to drive that bus and make people start to realize maybe it's time to rethink things. And, you know, it's not too far away.
You know, it occurred to me that, you know, I built this radio station in Hawaii last June. Earlier this year. And we bought an automation system. And one of the options that you could check the box when you ordered the automation was, do you want it to have LiveWire audio over IP? And we checked that box. And guess what? It showed up with LiveWire and a second network card in it and no analog I/O at all. No sound card. I mean, I think the original computer motherboard that's inside it has, you know, the typical crappy analog I/O. But yeah, we saved the money that you would have had to spend for a sound card. And that's been going on for years when, you know, people put an IP driver in an automation system. And of course, we've seen a couple of microphones, one on the market and one, I'm not sure if they've ever brought it out yet, that just has an RJ45 on it. One's a Neumann with a rack mount box, and the other is an Electrovoice microphone that just has an RJ45 on it. We've seen speakers, Genelec speakers, that have AES67 on them. So it's happening. And you know what? As the TV world moves into video and audio over IP, then I think we're going to see we'll see the high end TV products that cost plenty of money. But I just got to believe we'll see more and more commoditization. I can't wait until Behringer brings out, you know, their AES67 or Dante. It'd probably be Dante. That seems to be more along their lines. But you know, you're going to have a Dante connector on a cheap console. Catfish, don't you think so?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, when we first came up with the idea for audio over IP, I was actually, it's kind of funny because when I came from Pacific to Telos, I had been observing that the console, you know, I was a console designer, so I was very excited about the fact that we had historically been the center of the radio studio. Always the console was in the middle of the radio studio. And over time, I was observing that the computer was becoming center stage and the console was being kind of pushed off onto the sidelines a bit. And I observed this and thought, you know, this is not a trend that's going to stop because more and more, I mean, we went from having various kinds of source material from cart machines to CDs to LPs to, you know, mag tape of various kinds. We used to play audio from a whole lot of different sources and it all ended up getting consolidated into the computer. And when that happened, it became the focal point of the radio studio. And so what I pitched to Steve Church, because Steve said he wanted to be in the console business, and I said, you know, if we're going to be in the console business, we need a computer connection, a native computer connection. Now, here's where it got a little weird. My idea was FireWire. I imagined that we'd have a FireWire connection right from the computer, you know, right into the console engine. And that would allow us to speak natively from the audio system, the computer system, into the console system, and you'd eliminate sound cards, but you'd also eliminate the thing you normally plug the sound cards into. And Steve was the one that said, you know, I think this is a good idea, but not FireWire. And I'll never forget the day he walked up to me at NAB with a Cisco brochure in his hand, and he said, this is it. This is it. We can do everything. Just like VOIP, we can do everything on this. And I'm looking at this brochure and I'm thinking, I can't get my computer to print reliably on my network. And we're gonna put audio on this. So I wasn't an instant convert when he presented this idea.
I think a lot of us were not instant converts until we realized what the heck it was that was keeping our printing from happening.
Right. but God bless him. Rest in peace, Steve. He got this and he pushed all of us in this direction. So, you know, my piece of this was that native connection, you know, between the computer and the console infrastructure. His piece of this was everything else and doing it all over IP. And it was a brilliant insight.
So one more thing that drives me along this line of thinking that audio connectors and analog and AES can really be going away. It just occurred to me right now. I mean, I at my radio stations, little small town Mississippi, Arkansas, Hawaii, Samoa radio stations, we're running virtualized environments for a lot, not all, but a lot of our automation systems and also for our streaming system. We have absolutely zero analog or AES3 audio into or out of any automation system and any streaming system that we have. It's all audio over IP live wire. And so, you know, the vast majority of audio that we play on the air and on our streams never, ever turns into analog or AES3, except at the transmitter side, we go into some audio. One processor takes live wire, the others don't. So we're getting there, and the more things get virtualized, the more we're there. And I think about this, the BBC in England, they're doing, while their machines aren't necessarily virtualized quite so much, they are PCs, and they're all talking to each other with audio over IP, happens to be live wire. And so you've got automation playout, you've got codecs, you've got phone systems, and you've got recording into systems. And it all happens with once the audio goes from a microphone into the system, it never again is analog until it hits a transmitter. So we're already doing this. Now, they've got a pretty expensive system. But I just got to let as everything else happens, you know, the Ethernet switches that we used to use for making live wire audio over IP happen used to be quite spendy. And they've been coming down quite a bit. And of course, I tend to buy used ones for $100 and they work just fine. But I just think this is going to be so commoditized. And I think certainly the virtualization happening and the commoditization going to happen right along with it. The commoditization having to do with consumer gear and pro gear only having a network connection and speaking Dante or AES-67. And then the virtualization, of course, you know, being back-end systems for broadcasters and their production systems. I'm sorry, go ahead. You're in this world of emerging video over IP.
It makes sense. Well, you know, the video over IP that Labo does, you'll recognize this, Kirk, is in some ways very similar to what we were doing with Axia, you know, 15 years ago. You know, the idea is to replace the large format TDM router, or what we call the baseband router, with an IP fabric, you know, a switch fabric that can replace that routing infrastructure, and it can be more flexible. And there's all kinds of benefits with this. You can imagine how difficult it is when the formats flip from HD to UHD and you've got an HD router and you've got $500,000 investment. And, you know, all of a sudden this is not a small thing. So, if instead though, you went from HD to UHD and your infrastructure was IP, it's probably going to scale, or at least the investment that you've got, a lot of it you're going to be able to keep. So, you know, a lot of the same benefits, basically reducing the cost of routing video and audio over a television infrastructure. The task is very similar to what we had to do with audio. It's just the bandwidth requirements are quite a bit different.
That sounds like
you're
muted.
I can't hear you. Yeah.
He's muted.
Can't hear you. Still can't.
That's
hear
why
you.
I need. That's why I need this.
Need the gadget.
The gadget. That's yeah.
Very
gizmo.
Need the gizmo. Yeah.
I need the gizmo because then it would have a light. And were you, Chris, and I, and you today, Catfish, were for the folks at home. We're all using a browser based Skype type system, and once you click mute, if you move your cursor away, the button goes away, and you forget that you know. But you're not there, so thank you.
So this probably wouldn't be a good time for me to introduce how cool virtualization is, you know, because you're demonstrating some of the flaws with it. But you know, as you were talking about the infrastructure moving more toward this, you use the term commodity IP. Let's not forget what some of the advantages are to moving in that direction. Sure, cost, convenience, reduced complexity in some ways. But one of the things that I think is pretty exciting, and this is kind of Labo's main area of expertise, is in the area of virtual control in radio studios. And we've been seeing, I guess you know that a lot of our clients are very high-end state broadcasters, for example. You know, we're the ones that have all the consoles at the Olympics. Maybe I'm not allowed to say that, but you know, this is kind of what Labo does for a living. So when a large state broadcaster, and by that I mean a country broadcaster, comes to us and says, "We want you to help us pioneer the next big thing in radio," you know, that's kind of where we like to work. And what we've been seeing more and more of lately is this idea of moving away from physical control surfaces and moving toward virtual control surfaces. And at first, this kind of started out like a dream. And in fact, it might have been your dream, Kirk, because when I was still at Axia, I think I had you telling me, "Hey, Mike, we could do this big touchscreen control surface and get rid of all the knobs and the faders." And I remember you pitching this idea to me, and I said, "Nobody will ever go for that." And boy, was I dead wrong, because some customers are really going for that. And this is one of the things that this technology enables us to do. Once we move away from, some of the infrastructure issues and everything's in IP, well, now we can control it in more interesting ways. And I think that virtualized control surfaces are a fascinating area, that are just starting to take off. We're seeing this more and more, at least with our business.
One thing that Alex Hartman told me when I was questioning him about, these virtualized control surfaces, multi-touch panels, some people really are objecting to these. And he says, the 20-year-olds aren't objecting to them. They don't want real knobs and faders. And remember, it's not the 60-year-old engineer that's buying this or that's going to use it. It's the kids that are going to be using it, if anybody. And they're perfectly comfortable swiping left and swiping right and swiping up and down.
I think part of the problem, Kirk, is the first implementation, and it always works this way when there's a disruptive technology. The first, I'll ask you this. You probably remember this. You remember the first computer-based automation systems? And they had the thing that looked like a cart machine on the screen?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and we laugh about that. We say, well, that's ridiculous. Well, why did they look that way? Because the operators wanted them to look that way because that's what they were familiar with. So the first consoles that we've seen on touchscreens, what have they looked like? Well, they've had linear faders down on the bottom, and then they've had round knobs up above that, and then meters up above that because that's what consoles look like. But let me ask you this. Do automation systems still look like old cart machines? They don't look anything like that anymore. No. Right. Because at some point we broke loose of that limitation of that, you know, of that history, of that habit. And as soon as we broke loose of that habit, we were able to design an interface that made more sense, that made more logical sense. So I have to ask the question, why do software-based consoles look like hardware-based consoles? What else could we do? And you know, without even getting into the wackiness of it, there's something very obvious that a software-based console can do that is instantly beneficial to everyone. And that is, if I'm only working with two faders, I don't need to look at 12 dead faders. But if I have a physical console, I'm looking at 12 dead faders, whether I'm using them or not. So, exactly. It's kind of this kind of thinking that we can get into now once we start talking about, virtual control surfaces. But I think we're going to have this debate for a long time. And, go ahead.
You know, some people make a sports analogy every time you bring a topic up. I'm going to make a Star Trek analogy. You know, when they would get in the shuttlecraft, there'd be like one or two of them and the seats for four more people in the back, right? But they had to take the whole shuttlecraft. But when you transport somebody to the surface, you only transport the people that have to go. And, you know, the other stuff doesn't have to go. So that's the beauty of software. We can just do what needs to get done. Hey, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back with some final thoughts, tip of the week from Chris. And I haven't asked Catfish for one, but Catfish, maybe you can think of a cool website or something that will help people, or a tip that will help folks out before we sign out. Hey, our show This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcasters General Store. And this week featuring the Broadcast Tools ProMix 4. Yes, another cool, simple device that does easy stuff. The ProMix 4 is a compact, full-featured mono audio mixing console, but it's perfect for almost any broadcast audio, especially going out on remotes. It features three combination mic line inputs and a dedicated fourth input that can be switched between a balanced line input and the built-in USB audio interface. Yep, just plug it right into your Windows or your Mac laptop, and there you go. It has 3/4-inch stereo headphone outputs. Those are included with individual controls for volume, mix, and pan, allowing custom headphone mixes. And other features include a switch-selectable program limiter, XLR program output, monitor output with muting and volume control, and mix-minus output for connection to an external telephone hybrid, and an on-air light relay output. It's a great choice for remote broadcasts and podcasting applications. This thing, and you know, some broadcast tools. So you know Don Wingate? Don Wingate makes good stuff. It seems to last and last and last. And so that's what you want to check out. It's online at broadcasttools.com, and look for the ProMix 4, from Broadcast Tools. And I'll tell you where you want to get it. You want to call my friends at Broadcasters General Store. Whether it's the ProMix 4 that you need or something else, BGS will help you find it, get it, get you the best price for it. It's amazing what their prices are. And you don't even have to tell them, hey, put a sharp pencil on this. They got a sharp pencil all the time. Their prices are really good. And one of the great benefits of doing business with Broadcasters General Store is they have a custom computer system that they've worked up over the decades to keep track of your order. You call them and say, hey, I haven't seen my order yet. Do you know where it is? Oh, yes, it was shipped from the factory 2 days ago, and you ordered 3 days shipping. It'll be there tomorrow. That's the kind of detail and granularity that BGS can bring you. So contact BGS, give them a call or go online. Online, you can go to bgs.cc, or you can give them a call at area code 352-622-7700. That's 352-622-7700. I have had them on speed dial for years. Good folks there at Broadcaster General Store. And thanks to them and to Broadcast Tools and the ProMix 4 for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, I'm going to run over to Chris Tobin to see what he's got for us in terms of a tip of the week. Chris, what you got for us?
Hang on. Uh-oh. Here we go. No, I'm here. Here we go. Tip of the week. I just used this weekend, actually. It's one of these Vault Alerts. You may recognize it from the Wisconsin Broadcast Association. This was courtesy of Broadcast General Store, actually. And it detects AC on circuits. You know, I was taking a potted TV transmitter this weekend with a friend, helped him dismantle and demolition. And we came across several conduits with cables in them, electrical cables, and nothing marked. We couldn't find out where the breakers were, so we used this to check it out. So it's very important. It fits in your pocket. You can carry it with you around the office if you like. And keep that at the transmitter. Keep one of them at least at the transmitter, because you never know when you have to come across checking circuits. And the other tip to go along with that is you should always keep an extra charging cable at the transmitter site. Okay, very, very important. Yesterday, while working on the TV site, a couple of the guys that were there were having problems with their phones, and they did not have a charger with them. It just so happened I did have mine. So we were able to get things going. So just two things to remember when you're out there in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. Check your AC. Make sure you don't get zapped. Be sure to have something to charge the phone to call 911.
Good deal. Good deal. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, we want to avoid calling 911. And I know Catfish had his wife, AJ, ready when he got the saw out, or the drill, but didn't have to use it. That's good.
She has no faith in me.
Hey, I've got a real quick tip, and I haven't found the link for it yet, but I'll put it in the show notes when I do. You know, there's this with the big TV repack, your wireless mic systems above 600 megahertz are going to, and Chris, are they going to be disallowed completely, or do you have to be super extra careful with them?
They're not disallowed completely yet. 2020 is when it all goes away. But I think above 608 megahertz is pretty much dead. There are two spots up there that are in the guard bands. You could do stuff. It gets dicey. But yeah.
So the folks at Sennheiser, Sennheiser's website has some helpful information about timelines of this and when it's going to happen, and how to, you know, get off of your 600 megahertz plus wireless mic frequencies. And, you know, broadcasters probably more in tune to this than other people. But hey, I want to say, if you're an engineer and you help out maybe at the local community theater or at a house of worship or a high school or university that may not be aware that their 600 or higher megahertz wireless mic system is now in the future is going to be disallowed. It's going to cause interference or receive interference from the new wireless carrier allocations. You're going to need to get off of those frequencies. And the folks at Sennheiser have a great website and good tools to tell you all about this and help you get it figured out. They even have a trade-in program, at least it's something, to trade in your old wireless mics for some new wireless mics. So I'll put something about that in the show notes. But broadcast engineer friends, you need to be aware of that and help out your friends that may not know so much about this. Hey, we've had this system for you. We just bought this system 2 years ago. What do you mean we can't use it anymore? Well, you can't use it above 600 megahertz. So there's some cool stuff out there to make that happen. Catfish, Mike Dosh, you got any tip of the week for our listeners?
Chris Tobin kind of stole my thunder a little bit. So I bought this gadget a few weeks ago, and what it is it's a measuring device. It's electronic tweezers, basically, and it allows you to do in-circuit testing. This has been pretty useful for me and the gadgets. I had some capacitors that were the wrong value in my circuit, and I didn't realize it. And this allowed me to find them very quickly and take care of the problem. It's got a tiny little OLED on it, and you probably can't see it on the screen, but
I can.
Oh yeah, it does everything. I mean, it'll tell you inductance, capacitance, resistance. It's pretty cool little device, and things have changed a lot since I was doing electronic design. There's a lot of really cool stuff out there now.
It looks like that's space so much for that just right. It looks like it's space just right to plug into an AC outlet.
You know, I hadn't thought about that, but it should work. I guess I'll try it. Let me get AJ to get the 911 on speed dial first, and then I'll go give it a shot.
I'm sorry, Chris, I interrupted you. Go ahead, please.
Oh, no. As you just say, it looks like it would fit in the outlet. I just simply said, call AJ into the room before you test.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know me, Chris. You know me too well.
Or you could wind up like the fourth member of the beam down party in the red outfit. Remember?
Ah, yeah. Yeah.
There's always the guy in the red outfit that gets transported down. Don't recognize who he is. He goes first.
He doesn't come back up. Yeah.
You guys do like your Star Trek analogies, don't you?
Sure, nerds. I could talk to you.
We've got it. We're about out of time. Our producer Suncast is about to flip the switch and make it all go dark. So, hey, Catfish, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure and a lot of fun to have you on the show. So good luck with Angry Audio. I appreciate you sponsoring the show. And thanks for talking about the future of audio as you see it. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. Chris Tobin, thank you once again for being here from New York City. Look forward to talking to you next week. And let's see, next week. Let's look at the show notes here just real quick. Programming note, next week. I don't know yet who our guest is going to be next week. We're thinking about doing the show live from a technology exhibition here in Nashville next week. And then we'll be off for Thanksgiving. And then Jeff Welton is going to be here before the month is out. Jeff Welton will be with us. So that's he's Educator of the Year for the SBE, or the SBE Educator of the Year. So. That'll be cool. All right. Thanks, guys, for being with us. Thanks to Suncast for producing our show and trying to keep up with us. Thanks to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. And, all our audio back at GFQ going through audio over IP. We're doing the show. I'm doing the show from my studio, my Telos Alliance studio. Thanks to the Telos Alliance for help making that possible, too. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.